is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Rising water after hurricane, the hurricane in Florida, Hurricane Milton, is forcing people to evacuate now, including Ashley Cabrera and her family. It's been a 1-2 punch with the first hurricane, Helene, and then Milton.
I have never seen where we've had two back-to-back hurricanes that have caused the kids to not be in school, to evacuate back-to-back. And I've never seen the kids in all of these years be off of school for an entire week.
Over 1.5 million customers still without power in Florida. Boeing announcing major job cuts as the company still dealing with striking workers. The company says it plans to cut 10% of its workforce. Boeing hasn't shown a profit since 2018. With the presidential election just 3 weeks away, former President Trump campaigned Friday in Colorado. Vice President Harris releasing a doctor's letter today saying she's in excellent health. Her running mate, Governor Tim Walz, is hunting pheasant this morning in Minnesota. Press is tagging along. This is ABC News. More bombings in the Middle East. Israeli strikes hit central Beirut, destroying a building, killing more than 20 people. ABC's James Longman is at the bombing site in Beirut.
This was an apartment building. It's now been entirely reduced to a pile of rubble. I mean, the entire area has been decimated. We saw paramedics removing a body from the rubble, debris, smashed up cars, a mattress there on the side of the road. Now, there was another building also hit across the two sites. Some 22 people have been killed, more than 100 injured. Now, the target, according to local reports, was a senior Hezbollah official, but no one is confirming that. And the thing about these assassination attempts is they don't come with any warning.
In California, the number of dairy workers who've been diagnosed with bird flu has now grown to at least six. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says all six people worked in the state's agricultural Central Valley and were in contact with infected dairy cattle. Officials say that the risk to the general public remains low. Dave Packer, ABC News.
This is an important announcement for Wisconsinites who plan to vote in the November 2024 election. Leading nonpartisan economists have analyzed the economic plans of Donald Trump and concluded that he would cause inflation to rise and the economy to slow. And 16 Nobel Prize-winning economists wrote a letter warning that Donald Trump would reignite inflation with his fiscally irresponsible budgets. Donald Trump's tariff plan would act as a national sales tax, costing the average family as much as $4,000 per year. But Vice President Kamala Harris's plan would help middle-class families deal with rising costs. In her first 100 days, Kamala Harris would pass a ban on price gouging at the grocery store. And as vice president, she worked to cap the cost of many prescription drugs, including insulin, saving many families thousands of dollars per year. On the economy, the choice is clear. Vote Kamala Harris for president. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together Action. www.abwt-action.org. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Farms and livestock operations are polluting the Mississippi River Basin like never before. As Mike Moan reports, a possible solution may be found out east.
Broader efforts to reduce harmful nutrients from reaching the Gulf of Mexico have largely failed. Mesa Khan is the former policy director at the Mississippi River Network. She says there isn't a lot of coordination among states and key agencies that are linked to this large source of water in establishing an effective model.
The way that we operate right now is very much a state-by-state kind of choose-your-own-adventure.
However, environmental observers point to an initiative to remove pollutants from Chesapeake Bay out east. For nearly 15 years, it's included a legally enforceable multi-state pollution quota, one of a select few in the nation. However, officials monitoring that program say even with marked improvements, they're still not meeting certain reduction targets, adding that other changes are needed. Any setbacks aren't deterring Midwestern organizations from urging federal government officials to spur a similar pollution quota covering all states along the Mississippi. Alicia Vasto of the Iowa Environmental Council says they'd appreciate a little more urgency.
Without that, I think we're kind of rudderless in the ways that we're trying to address pollution.
An estimated 60-80% of the nitrogen flowing from the Mississippi Basin to the Gulf originates at farms and livestock operations. Chemicals commonly used to grow crops and fertilize lawns can cause algae blooms and die-offs that rob waters of oxygen and suffocate aquatic life. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. This story was produced with original reporting from Bennett Goldstein for Wisconsin Watch.
This is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, partly sunny, slight chance of a sprinkle and a high near 65. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows around 42. Windy with a chance of showers on Sunday, highs near 57. Chance of showers Sunday night, lows in the mid-30s. For Monday, mostly sunny, 55.
Right now, it's 55.
Pat Kreitlow.
Monday morning on Up North News Radio, the group Veterans for Responsible Leadership weighs in on what vets should be thinking about before casting a ballot next month.
Up North News with Pat Kreitlow, weekday mornings starting at 6.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Matt and Air on Air.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. Welcome to this, the second hour in our weekly weekend broadcast of all things justice-related, rule of law-related, and yes, courts-related, focusing this weekend on the United States Supreme Court beginning its new term, the 2024-2025 term, just underway as of this past Monday, the first Monday in October. Already 40 cases on its docket, and five of them already the subject of oral arguments just this past week. Talking in this second hour of our broadcast all about what those cases are all about, and giving you some sense of some of the upcoming oral arguments, the cases the Supreme Court has already decided to decide in a number of different areas, a number of different subject matters important to the future and the present of our nation. Specifically, just this past week, on Tuesday, the court entertaining this question of whether or not the government, the ATF, can regulate ghost guns, these kits that you can purchase and bring together the component pieces and create a gun. And up to now, until the regulation prohibited this from happening, you could do this in an unregistered way. The new rule from ATF required by the federal government mandates that manufacturers of the component parts serialize those parts, that your numbers on those parts, so that when they're manufactured, they're like any other gun. That indeed there is a method of tracing them if they become involved in any sort of criminal or even non-criminal conduct that basically brings them within the ambit of other gun regulations. And the Supreme Court, probably by a 5-4 majority of the present court this past Tuesday, indicating that the regulation will stand. Plainly a loss, if you will, if that's what happens in the end for the gun industry, but a victory for those among us, many of you as well, I suspect, who regard the Supreme Court's decisions under the Second Amendment as specifically saying that, yes, indeed, you can issue regulations and conditions and limitations on all sorts of things related to guns. That comes out of Heller. That comes out of Bruin. The Supreme Court cases that establish the rights to carry weapons in America, nonetheless, a right that is conditioned upon things that legislatures can, in fact, do. It appears that the Supreme Court is going to say that the ATF regulation, appropriate, nothing wrong about it, and also an affirmation, if you will, of the expertise inside the ATF itself. It says, yes, this is the kind of thing we need to do to keep Americans safe and secure. We've talked a lot on this broadcast about the implications of Chevron and this Loper Bright Enterprises case, also hugely significant, hugely catastrophic for the operation of government by suggesting that agencies don't know what they're talking about, federal courts no longer having to defer to them when it comes to expertise. Here at least, it appears the United States Supreme Court is going to say that indeed the ATF got it right, maybe deferring in some sense to the expertise, the people who know what they're talking about there, and saying, yes, indeed, this is a way of keeping us all safe and secure. We'll see what happens. Probably May, maybe June, could be any time coming up. Significantly, the other important points that I will make before we move on to our other major case, this death penalty case, the case comes out of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. We're going to be hearing a lot from them, not only in this broadcast, but in future broadcasts as well. Lots of focus from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. In 2023, Judge Reed O'Connor of the District Court in the Northern District of Texas, which is a federal district court inside the Fifth Circuit, agreed that the administration had overstepped, agreed with those people who are seeking to challenge this regulation. He said, even if it is true that such an interpretation creates loopholes that as a policy matter should be avoided, it is not the role of the judiciary to correct them. That is up to Congress, basically saying that the trial court, the district court there, we're going to keep our hands off of regulation of this kind. Congress can do that, but the agency should not. Three judges from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit agreed with Judge Reed O'Connor, saying that the regulation has to fall. The case is called Garland versus Vanderstock. Garland versus Vanderstock. And it has reached the justices before on an emergency basis. In prior times, the court, again, by a 5-4 vote, Justice Roberts, Justice Barrett joining the liberal wing, sided with the Biden administration at that time, reinstating the regulations on a limited basis as the legal challenge continued. Now, that challenge completed, if you will, by presentation to the Supreme Court. Likely, the Supreme Court, with these two justices joining the other three by a 5-4 majority, probably saying that the ATF regulation can stand. Ghost guns subject to regulation, different from what they did last term when it comes to bump stocks, not subject to regulation. An interesting dichotomy, if you will, of what the Supreme Court's doing in the area of guns. Then on Wednesday of just this past week, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in one singular case. The case is Glossip, Glossip versus Oklahoma. Let's talk about what the Supreme Court did, what it had before it in that particular case. The Supreme Court pretty much fractured on this particular case, wrestling with the case of an Oklahoma death row inmate. And some evidence has come to light that one of the principal prosecution witnesses, probably information not disclosed about his background. Again, in our system, a requirement, an absolute mandate that is a part of our adversarial system, the defense provided with all the information that the government has. That's how we operate. That's how our justice system works. And absent doing that, if you withhold something, whether it's through negligence or intention, the conviction, if you get it, will be compromised. And indeed, that's what the question is here with respect to a witness that was presented by the government years ago in connection with Richard Glossop's prosecution. And so he is a death row inmate. He is in Oklahoma. His challenge to his conviction comes from a fairly extraordinary concession by the state's attorney general. And along the way, as a result of that concession, which we will get to, some justices wondering what the remedy should be here. Some of them wondering if they had the power to grant the relief that the defendant here, Richard Glossop, is seeking. Others seem very ready to order a new trial based upon this problem that's now been identified, or at least send it back for an evidentiary hearing so a lower court judge can determine more about exactly what did and did not happen here. Has to do with the prosecutor's long suppressed notes. So how do we get there? Well, Glossop was convicted of arranging the death of his employer, the owner of a motel in Oklahoma City years ago. Two independent investigations since that conviction cast some serious doubt on his guilt, and some critical evidence was being withheld at the time. Major testimony was apparently faulty. State lawmakers from both political parties, along with some celebrities out there as well, have called for a new trial. This has gotten the attention of a lot of people, or maybe at a minimum some clemency. And indeed, Paul Clement, who used to be a Solicitor General of the United States of America, now still presents many cases before the Supreme Court. He's representing Oklahoma in this case, the prosecution, the state in this case. He tells the justices on Tuesday, and certainly in his prior memorandum, that his client's position, Richard Glossop's capital conviction was tainted. This is the government saying it was tainted by prosecutorial misconduct, making a new trial imperative. This is the government coming forward, as it should in these cases, saying that even though the underlying offense may or may not have happened, the process means everything. And if you don't have an accurate and justice-based process, the conviction that comes from that must be overturned, a new trial ordered. That's what Paul Clement, representing Oklahoma, says to the Supreme Court just this past week. He said this: our prosecutors elicited perjury here, and a man's going to his death. He characterized the reluctant conclusion, conclusion of the state's attorney general, saying we can't allow this to happen. The attorney general of the position that, yes, indeed, we need to go back and reanalyze what happened in this case. Glossop again convicted based almost entirely on this, on the testimony of the state's star witness. He's a handyman. His name is Justin Sneed, S-N-E-E-D. He had pleaded guilty to killing Barry Van Treese, a motel owner, beating him to death in 1997 with a baseball bat. In exchange for a life sentence as opposed to the imposition of the death penalty, Sneed agreed to testify against Glossop. And the Sneed said that Glossop had instructed him, that is Sneed, to kill Mr. Van Treese. And so the three of them, again, the victim here, the two sort of co-defendants here, one of them agrees to plead guilty and testify against Mr. Glossop. And that's how this conviction comes about. And again, it is also the basis upon which the conviction ultimately comes apart. Why? Because recently disclosed notes appear to contradict Sneed's testimony about whether he had been treated by a psychiatrist. Again, everything related to a defense witness, a prosecution witness here, needs to be disclosed. And those notes seem to show that he had been diagnosed, that is Sneed, with bipolar disorder. When I was arrested, Sneed had testified, I asked for some Sudafed because I had a cold. But then shortly after that, somehow they ended up giving me lithium for some reason. I don't know why. I've never seen a psychiatrist or anything. So the prosecutor emphasized that testimony. So you don't know why they gave you that. And Mr. Sneed, again, during the trial, had said no. Why is this all significant? Why is this important? What does this all mean? Well, the newly disclosed notes prepared by the prosecutor here contain two contested phrases. On lithium, one said, and Dr. Trumpet was another. Those are the specific notes. The second question was an apparent reference to a fellow named Dr. Lawrence Tromka, T-R-O-M-B-K-A, who is the sole psychiatrist at the jail where Sneed was held after the murder. Lawyers for Glossop and the state said that those phrases showed that Sneed had testified falsely. They did perjure himself during the course of the trial about how he came to be taking lithium, and the prosecutor had failed to correct him. Prosecutorial misconduct, producing ultimately perjury, the false statement by Sneed, the government's principal witness, and ultimately a conviction of Glossop based upon perjured testimony. Now, again, those notes figured principally upon Glossop's bid here for the new trial. The Oklahoma Court of Appeals, interestingly, unanimously rejected this what's called a confession of error, said, well, we know that this happened, but we're rejecting it nonetheless. And much of the argument at the lower court level involves whether they can review and remedy this situation. As we come back, I'll explain that more and tell you what the Supreme Court has before it in this case involving Mr. Glossop and the death penalty in 2024 as Amicus, a law review, continues.
This is the talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM. The Dom Salvia Show.
Ann Egan Walkoff from Wisconsin Native Vote.
20 years ago, I moved to a suburb of Milwaukee. I went to register, and the woman was like, you're Indian? Indians don't vote. You can't vote.
What?
So when I'm talking to a group of Native Americans, did I tell them that story? And they're like, what? And that gets their dander up. And I'm going to go yeah, vote for sure.
Absolutely.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
Out here in the middle of all these acres, it can feel like you're the only person on earth. And sometimes that's how it feels when you're going through tough times. Trouble sleeping, your mind racing. So what do? We get help. There are people in our community who are here for us. Sometimes just talking to someone can make all the difference in the world. Find more information at loveyourmindtoday.org. That's loveyourmindtoday.org. Brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ad Council.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus Law Review. This is the second segment in our second hour here in our weekend broadcast, talking about oral arguments before the United States Supreme Court in this, the first week of its term in the 2024-2025 term, and addressing in particular this thorny case, this difficult case involving the conduct upon which Mr. Richard Glossop was convicted. He is on death row right now, and a decision by everybody, basically, the defense and the state as well, confession of error, that in the trial that resulted in his conviction and his placement on death row there in Oklahoma, there was perjured testimony coming from the government's principal witness, a fellow named Sneed, having to do with his treatment, his medical treatment, his psychiatric treatment, and a misrepresentation by the defendant, by the witness for the prosecution, that resulted in an unfair trial for this defendant, the failure of the prosecution to correct at the time, and now as a result of notes recently revealed indicating that the prosecutor knew about it and did nothing to correct it. The United States Supreme Court, again, trying to resolve this case in oral argument, in part resting upon this kind of thorny, wonky issue that the Court of Appeals in the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals was also wrestling with, whether it could review a decision of that lower court. It's a question that turns on whether the decision rested on an independent and adequate state ground. Very wonky, very down the rabbit hole here. The justices, during the oral argument, spending a lot of time quoting from and trying to make sense of the state court's decision, and apparently with little success in doing that. Again, trying to understand what it is the Oklahoma Court of Appeals did in this case, invoking this independent, adequate state ground position to reject this confession of error and reject Glossop's petition that he be given a new trial. What Justice Kagan said during the course of the oral argument was this. She said, "I've read it a dozen times." She's talking about the Criminal Appeals Court's decision. "I'm still not sure what each paragraph is doing exactly. What or where or why?" That is a stunning indication that obviously the United States Supreme Court will be overturning what the Oklahoma Court of Appeals, the Criminal Court of Appeals, did in that case. The question is how they should do that. Can they grant relief? And if so, in what way? Some justices are plainly ready to order a new trial in this case, or at least an evidentiary hearing to address what happened below. All of that coming up again in the case called Glossop, G-L-O-S-S-I-P versus Oklahoma. Significantly, the other reason why this case is significant now is it's another instance where you've got a justice, in this case, Neil Gorsuch, doing what we've talked a lot about, and that is recusing himself, taking himself off the case. Why? Because he had heard an aspect of the case as an appeals court judge when he was in the 10th Circuit many years ago. And so again, here we've got a situation where appropriately you've got a Supreme Court judge or any judge out there. If you've previously been involved in the case, you take yourself off that case. Recusal, an appropriate decision by Judge Gorsuch, underscoring the notion that when justices or judges have conflicts of not only interest, but also conflicts that would suggest that their ultimate opinion may not be given the weight that it should otherwise be given, that under those circumstances, they should not be deciding the case. Significant inside this very important death penalty case, almost certainly Mr. Glossop being given some type of remedy. What that may look like, we're not certain yet. The Supreme Court acknowledging that something very bad happened here, something very tragic happened here, something very unjust happened here. This testimony by Sneed that resulted principally in the conviction of a defendant, placing him on death row, finding him guilty of murder there in Oklahoma. And because of that, likely sometime soon, perhaps, maybe even long before June, the Supreme Court in this Glossop case issuing an order saying some remedy, some relief has got to be granted to this death row inmate as a part of its jurisprudence, recognizing once again, Supreme Court has said over many years that under the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment, the Eighth Amendment does not prohibit the imposition of a death penalty under appropriate circumstances. Many states have it. Many states do not. We do not have the death penalty here in Wisconsin. But if you do have the death penalty, the Supreme Court has said, you have to cross all the T's, dot all the I's, and that is understating it dramatically. Why? Because you're doing the single most significant, most dramatic thing that a government can do. Not only incarcerate you, but then impose a death penalty upon you. And before any rational, reasonable system of justice would do that, including right here in America, any state can do that. You need to make certain that every single thing in the prosecution is as fair and as just as possible here when you've got a situation where a witness, Snead here, plainly perjured himself, at least according to the notes now produced. That's got to be the subject of a remand and some reconsideration and likely a new trial, even after these many years, to determine whether that particular testimony, number one, can come in at all. And if so, should it be in the context of the disclosure of this kind of information? All those things to be decided when the Supreme Court issues its decision. Once again, Glossop versus Oklahoma, the second of five cases heard by the United States Supreme Court just this past week. Many more coming up, many more among the 40 or so, ultimately 60 cases likely to be on the docket of the United States Supreme Court in this term. We're going to talk with you as the Supreme Court continues to have these oral arguments, entertaining argument from the litigants, from the lawyers, as these cases come up. But let's right now spend some time chatting about some of those other major cases that are on the docket. Not yet the subject of these oral arguments. Let's begin with this probably the most significant, the largest, the highest publicity case of this term so far. The biggest ticket item so far, it's called United States versus Scrimeti, S-K-R-M-E-T-T-I, United States versus Scrimeti. It is a challenge, a major challenge to a Tennessee law that bans medical treatments for transgender youth. Transgender minors. This is a transgender issue, plainly. It is among the very first times the Supreme Court has issued and wrestled with opinions in this area. More than 20 states in the United States of America have similar laws that ban some types of medical treatment, some kind of health care for transgender minors. And so this is no small matter. And it opens, plainly, a new door, if you will, for the Supreme Court addressing transgender rights in America. That's the reason why when it comes to the civil rights docket, the human rights docket, this case may well be the most significant one it decides among many others, some of which we've already discussed this weekend. The Tennessee law specifically prohibits medical providers from prescribing puberty blockers or hormones to treat the psychological distress caused by the incongruence between experienced gender and that assigned at birth. Now, the Biden administration in this case, not surprisingly, has argued that the law violates the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. You're treating people who are equally positioned differently. That's a violation of the Constitution. These laws, this law passed by the Tennessee legislature prohibiting medical providers from prescribing these particular medicines to address the psychological distress here, all those kinds of things, unconstitutional. And that's the issue before the Supreme Court. And so as we continue here on Amicus, a law review, I'll tell you more about what that's all about and why it is the Supreme Court again has decided to take this case as Amicus, a law review, continues.
You're listening to the Talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Rising water after Hurricane The hurricane in Florida, Hurricane Milton, is forcing people to evacuate now, including Ashley Cabrera and her family. It's been a 1-2 punch with the first hurricane, Helene, and then Milton.
I have never seen where we've had two back-to-back hurricanes that have caused the kids to not be in school, to evacuate back-to-back. And I've never seen the kids in all of these years be off of school for an entire week.
Over 1.5 million customers still without power in Florida. Boeing announcing major job cuts as the company still dealing with striking workers. The company says it plans to cut 10% of its workforce. Boeing hasn't shown a profit since 2018. With the presidential election just 3 weeks away, former President Trump campaigned Friday in Colorado. Vice President Harris releasing a doctor's letter today saying she's in excellent health. Her running mate, Governor Tim Walz, is hunting pheasant this morning in Minnesota. Press is tagging along. This is ABC News.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
Badgers football today. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Wisconsin Badgers are in New Jersey to take on Rutgers. Wisconsin with a record of 3-2. Rutgers is 4-1. In Green Bay, Packers wide receiver Romeo Doubs says he had some things going on mentally that led to his one-game suspension last weekend. Doubs spoke to reporters after yesterday's practice.
I had some things going on mentally. I do not feel comfortable getting too deep into that. But just, you know, you guys hearing it from me, there are some things I had going on myself. So I did my best communicating, and I'm just thankful that, you know, that I'm here right now, you know, able to still play ball.
The Packers host the Arizona Cardinals tomorrow, and quarterback Kyler Murray says he's looking forward to his first game at Lambeau Field.
It's going to be a good challenge for us to go on the road, a place I haven't played before personally, first time, great environment, be, you know, really historic place. A lot of great players have played in that stadium, so I'm excited about it.
As Cardinals quarterback Kyler Murray with sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, partly sunny, slight chance of a sprinkle and a high near 65. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows around 42. Windy with a chance of showers on Sunday, highs near 57. Chance of showers Sunday night, lows in the mid-30s. For Monday, mostly sunny, 55.
Right now, it's 55.
Whether you own a local business or a global one, you're always looking for ways to position your operation to create opportunities and move on them faster. With Bank of America, you get access to experts, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter, locally and globally. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Copyright 2024 Bank of America N.A.
Have you outgrown your health insurance plan? The number one reason we all change our health insurance is price. Are you paying too much for your health insurance? Would you like to have better coverage at a better rate? Take a few minutes right now and find out if you can save money or even qualify for zero-cost health insurance in your state. Call now.
800-693-9308. 800-693-9308. That's 800-693-9308.
Farmers in Wisconsin have always been ahead of the times, and it's no different in the mid-1800s. George Esterly was running a large wheat farm outside of Whitewater, but reaping his crop by hand was back-breaking work. Esterly invented a mechanical harvesting machine and used it in his own fields in 1844. He then won a Chicago Mechanics Gold Medal 4 years later. But was he the first in the country to build a harvesting machine? The answer is coming up. Esterly followed up his win by opening a factory in the Whitewater area, building the harvesting machines and eventually other farm equipment too. By the 1880s, 500 people worked there. So was Esterly the first in the country to build a new mechanical harvesting machine? Yes, this man's early farm invention lives on as a remarkable slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr.
Dom Selvia.
Next time, Nick Ramos, executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, will talk about Christian nationalism's unholy war on democracy, plus an update on Wausau Mayor Doug Denny.
The Dom Selvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6.
Thank you.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this, the remaining segments of our weekend broadcast, talking all about the Supreme Court, things on its 40-case docket in this, its new term, its 2024-2025 term, perhaps the single most significant case, among others, that again are also hugely important, is this transgender matter coming out of the states out there that have passed laws that prohibits medical providers from providing puberty blockers and hormones to treat the psychological distress caused by the incongruence between experienced gender and that assigned at birth. That's how the case is described. This particular focus is upon Tennessee law that does just that. The Biden administration, again, taking the position that that kind of thing is unconstitutional. It's illegal in violation of the Equal Protection Clause. And significantly, the case is important for a number of reasons. One, of course, the underlying issue related to LGBTQIA rights. That is significant. Civil rights generally for all Americans. And also because of the constitutional scrutiny, the level of scrutiny given this kind of thing, the challenge here to the Tennessee law and the other 20 states out there likely to prevail only if the court, the Supreme Court, rules that the law is subject to heightened constitutional scrutiny, that you've really got to overcome a lot to justify this, requiring states to demonstrate that their laws are substantially related to achieving an important state objective. In other words, what are you doing when you're accomplishing this, when you're legislating in this way? You've got to say, you've got to establish somehow that the result of what you're doing is substantially related to some very important state objective. What is that? What are you trying to accomplish, and how do you get there? Sex-based classifications are typically subject to that kind of scrutiny. But the parties here are disputing whether the law discriminates based upon sex. And so you've got that fundamental notion, which we've seen before in other cases, about whether or not this is a case about sex or something else. Of course, it is. It is about rights. It's about humanity. And that's the other reason why this case is so important. But it also underscores this legal issue about the level of scrutiny given to transgendered rights and transgender medical care coming out of Tennessee and these other states. The administration has also urged the Supreme Court here to rule that distinctions based on transgender status must be subjected to heightened scrutiny, but that argument, again, may not prevail in this particular case. The administration taking the view that this is unconstitutional and that the standards that you apply to this kind of analysis of these laws will result in that decision, that is, of unconstitutionality on behalf of our transgender community. We'll continue to monitor that. The case, again, scheduled for oral argument, going to be a big one when that happens. The case, once again, United States versus Crametti, S-K-R-M-E-T-T-I. Many other cases also on the docket of the Supreme Court. I indicated before that another case coming out of the Fifth Circuit, which has a reputation, again, for issuing, as we're seeing even in this weekend broadcast, issuing some extreme rulings, is subject to further review by the Supreme Court. It has to do with the appeal in an online pornography case. The case is called Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton. And yes, again, Paxton is the Attorney General of the state of Texas. It concerns a state law that seeks to limit minors' access to sexual materials on the Internet. And how do you do that, according to this Texas law? By requiring age verification measures like the submission of government-issued IDs before you can get access to the pornography. Interestingly, a divided panel of the Fifth Circuit rejected a First Amendment challenge to the law, applying a relaxed form of judicial scrutiny. And that ruling, of course, seems to be somewhat at odds, somewhat controversial, and somewhat inconsistent with a case called Ashcroft versus ACLU. That's a 2004 decision in which the justices blocked a federal law that was very similar to the one from Texas. And there they applied the most demanding form of judicial review, strict scrutiny, to find that the law impermissibly interfered with adults' First Amendment rights. Question here, does Texas, in its legislative action, have the right to limit minors' access to sexual materials upon the requiring age verification to show that you're 18 or older, like the submission of government-issued IDs, case involving pornography, at least indirectly, and more significantly, First Amendment rights, what level of judicial scrutiny is going to be addressed in that case as well. Another case, once again, from the Fifth Circuit. A lot of cases coming out of the Fifth Circuit. We know there are 8 already, maybe even more on the docket coming up as the Supreme Court grants more writs of certiorari. Another case coming from the Fifth Circuit, also involving minors. This one on flavored e-cigarettes. And the question before the justices, asking them to decide whether the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, again, an agency making a decision here, acted lawfully in refusing to accept an application from 2 manufacturers of flavored liquids called Jimmy the Juice Man Peachy Strawberry, Signature Series Mom's Pistachio, and Suicide Bunny Mother's Milk and Cookies, all of those e-flavored cigarettes. And the question is whether or not the FDA properly rejected the applications of the manufacturers of those e-cigarettes as a part of its oversight of FDA issues, whether they overstepped when it comes to e-cigarettes, their capacity, again, sort of a Chevron Loper Bright Enterprises case, but also going to the expertise inside the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. How will the Supreme Court decide that particular case? Again, coming out of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals and that appellate court giving the Supreme Court a lot of business in this term. Among the many cases the court has agreed to hear, you've also got this very interesting case. It's called Smith & Wesson versus Estados Unidos Mexicanos. And yes, as the case would suggest, the name of the case suggests, it comes from Mexico. Mexico itself, the state of Mexico, the nation of Mexico, attempting to hold American gun manufacturers to account, holding them responsible. That's the request of this case for what it says, what Mexico says, is their role in aiding the drug cartel's gun carnage. That's their language to describe what the result has been by the American gun manufacturers' involvement in gun manufacturing and presumably distribution as well. Mexico coming forward and saying, there is liability here for what you have done, American gun manufacturers. We're going to try to hold you responsible in a federal court here, ultimately in the Supreme Court now, for what you have done when it comes to the drug problem in Mexico, the work, the operation of cartels there, and specifically the ways in which they've operated using firearms, that the gun manufacturers here in America are directly responsible for the drug operations of those cartels in Mexico, an attempt to hold those gun manufacturers responsible for what they have done here in Mexico, the consequences of their behavior. Interesting case, again, brought by the nation of Mexico in our federal court, reaching now the United States Supreme Court. On the morning after Election Day, November 6th, the court is going to consider, have an oral argument, a case called Facebook versus Amalgamated Bank. Facebook versus Amalgamated Bank. It's a securities class action over whether Facebook has adequately disclosed a data breach that it suffered, allowing Cambridge Analytica to harvest the private information of millions of its users. You may recall this issue as it broke many years ago. The issue is whether or not, again, in this securities class action, Facebook adequately disclosed what happened at the time of that data breach, that Cambridge Analytica gave them access to private information of millions of Facebook users, whether or not that particular lawsuit can proceed. Facebook versus Amalgamated Bank is the name of that case, also pending in front of the United States Supreme Court. A week after our election here in the United States of America, the Supreme Court going to hear oral argument on another securities fraud action. This one's called NVIDIA versus Oman J or Founder AB. Lots of things to consume there. NVIDIA, NVIDIA versus Oman or Founder, Fonder. This one accuses NVIDIA, now the dominant manufacturer of chips for artificial intelligence services. NVIDIA, the principal manufacturer of chips for AI services, of misrepresenting its reliance on the cryptocurrency mining industry in 2017 and 2018. There's a lot to unpack there. Allegations here that NVIDIA, again, the major manufacturer of the AI services here, misrepresented its reliance on cryptocurrency mining way back in 2017, 2018. Why is that significant? Again, because this is a securities fraud class action brought by people investing plainly in NVIDIA, having other relationships with it of a transactional nature, and saying NVIDIA has lied about its engagement with the cryptocurrency mining industry, that market, and therefore violated securities laws. Whether or not that is the basis for remedies, that's what the Supreme Court is also going to be deciding in that case coming up in just a few weeks. Now, all of this, of course, comes at a time that the Supreme Court's reputation generally among Americans is at, if not an all-time low, a very close to all-time low. In a survey released just last week, the folks who offered this survey opportunity for many people producing the results now, a group called the Annenberg Public Policy Center documented what it called a stunning decrease in distrust of the Supreme Court over the past two decades. And listen to what they found, the Annenberg Public Policy Center, this survey released even as the Supreme Court is beginning this new term. Just 44% of respondents surveyed in July and August expressed trust that the high court would act in the best interests of people like them. That is indeed the lowest level since the center began asking the question in 2005. At that time, 2005, 75% of the public trusted the court, a dramatic drop, even as the Supreme Court entertains these oral arguments and places more cases on its docket. A second survey, also released last week, this one from Gallup, found some deep polarization in the public's review of the court. 72% of Republicans surveyed in September approved the job it's doing. 15% of Democrats did not. And again, the Supreme Court causing a lot of dissension, disagreement, not only among political parties and partisans in America, but also generally its reputation, suffering an awful lot based upon its decisions, certainly, but also upon the conduct. And we've talked a lot about the behavior of those Supreme Court justices, including especially Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas, others arguably in that ambit. The absolute need to restore some integrity, some sense of trust and confidence in the Supreme Court as it makes these major decisions in all of these areas, including transgender rights and civil rights, including allegations brought by Mexico against our gun manufacturers here, data breaches, securities fraud, all kinds of things having to do with the future of America, ghost guns, death row, abortion, all those kinds of things pending before the Supreme Court, requiring that when the Supreme Court issues its decisions, could begin to do so after the oral arguments in the early months and certainly into the mid-months of 2025. As it does that, the American public needs to have trust and confidence that those decisions are the products of review at oral arguments based upon the memorandums and are not in any way the product of bias or prejudice or some other conflict of interest, whether it's involvement with people who are appearing in front of you, that's been a problem, as we've seen. Whether it's simply a problem of confidence in where your sources of income, that's another problem that we have seen among at least two, if not more, justices of the Supreme Court. Again, a compelling call, as always, for the Supreme Court not only to embrace a unified code of ethics, which the lower courts have done, but also, as many justices have now said, including most notably Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson, some enforcement mechanism for all of that to ensure that the Supreme Court, when it issues these decisions, is making decisions based upon ethics and not other considerations. In our final segment, we have a few more cases also coming out of the Fifth Circuit, now pending before the United States Supreme Court, as Amicus, a law review, continues this analysis.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, LaCrosse's home for the Todd Allball Show. Matt Nair on air.
She's the fabulous farm babe. She is Pam Yonke. One of the reports that you guys did from last week was about the cow photographers.
When you go to World Dairy Expo, it never ceases to amaze me. Hair dryers, goop for their hair, for their hooves, everything. When it's time for them to go potty, somebody walks around behind them with a bucket. Now that's pampering, if you ask me.
Matt Nair on air, weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
I learned patience from my adoptive dad. All he had to say was,
"Hey, you got this. Just breathe." Hey, we're pretty good.
Yeah.
Might have to start a band.
I got it.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to find out more. This message is brought to you by AdoptUS Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Eagle 1490 AM.
This is Amicus Law Review, the final segment of our two-hour program and discussion this weekend on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, talking about the cases on the docket of the United States Supreme Court. A lot of them, a whopping eight cases to this point, coming out of the Fifth Circuit alone. Let's add more. Among that eight, three more cases involving death penalty and nuclear waste and other matters coming out of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. More cases pending in front of the Supreme Court coming out of that circuit than any other circuit in the nation. Let's talk about DNA testing and the death penalty. Another death penalty case, again, coming out of the Fifth Circuit. Supreme Court has agreed to hear a death penalty case challenging the denial of DNA testing to a man who claims that that test would prove his innocence in a 1998 murder of a Texas woman. The man, whose name is Ruben Gutierrez, has asked the court to take his case after a divided panel, judges of the Fifth Circuit, rejected his appeal and cleared the way for his execution. The justices halted that execution in July, just minutes before Mr. Gutierrez was scheduled to be killed. The case again centers on whether a prisoner can bring a constitutional challenge against a state DNA statute that could limit access to potentially exonerating evidence. An important issue, again, coming out of the Fifth Circuit. Gutierrez is the name of the case. There's also another case coming out of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Supreme Court agreeing to decide whether a federal agency is authorized by Congress to license a private entity to store spent nuclear fuel in the state of Texas. A unanimous three-judge panel, again, in the Fifth Circuit, ruled last year that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, that is the agency, the NRC, lacked the authority to grant licenses for the temporary off-site storage of the nuclear waste. The Fifth Circuit held that the federal law plainly contemplates that until there's a permanent repository, spent nuclear fuel is to be stored on-site at the reactor or in a federal facility. Fifth Circuit declined to hear the case. Dissenting judge there wrote the panel's decisions has grave consequences for the regulated entity's settled expectations and careful investments in costly, time-consuming agency proceedings. The Solicitor General urging the Supreme Court to intervene, noting that two other appellate courts have come to an opposite conclusion to that of the Fifth Circuit, and ruling that federal law authorizes the commission to license the temporary off-site storage of spent nuclear fuel. In reaching a contrary conclusion, she wrote, the Fifth Circuit disturbed the commission's authority to safely regulate nuclear materials by issuing those licenses, an authority the commission has exercised for more than 40 years, once again underscoring this focus upon agency authority and discretion being argued by the Solicitor General in this case involving nuclear waste, also in front of the Supreme Court in this term. And finally, also coming again out of the Supreme Court among the eight cases, says the Supreme Court is going to take a case on whether courts can assess whether an officer acted with a reasonable force. A three-judge panel for the Fifth Circuit again determined this year that a police officer in Texas reasonably feared for his life when he fatally shot a driver during a 2016 traffic stop in Houston. The panel, the appellate panel there, found that Officer Roberto Felix had acted within the bounds of the Fourth Amendment's so-called moment of fear doctrine when he killed Ashtian Barnes, who is the victim in that case. He's 24 years old. In its ruling, the panel wrote that under this doctrine, the moment of death doctrine, the court must ask whether an officer was in danger at the moment of the threat that caused him to use deadly force. The actions of the officer preceding that moment were not relevant, it added. And one of the judges, in a concurrence, expressed frustration with this test that established by the Court of Appeals and urged the Supreme Court to intervene to clarify this entire situation and basically provide clear direction on what the standard is, this moment of threat doctrine having to do with, once again, with a police-involved shooting and how that implicates this particular matter, the case involving here a shooting there in Texas. A principal judge there on the Fifth Circuit, his name is Patrick Higginbotham, said this. He said a routine traffic stop has again ended in an unarmed black man and the death of an unarmed black man. And again, we cloak a police officer with qualified immunity, which is what the focus of this really all is all about, shielding his liability. It is a qualified immunity case. And inside that is this moment of death doctrine. He added, to these eyes, that is the judge's eyes, binding an officer's role in bringing about the threat, precipitating the use of deadly force, lessens the Fourth Amendment's protection of the American public. He said it devalues human life and frustrates the interest of the individual and of society in judicial determination of guilt and punishment. Well, the Supreme Court's now going to wrestle with all of that. It's a case in plainly involving police shooting, but also involving this issue of moment of threat doctrine and specifically qualified immunity back on the docket coming out of the Fifth Circuit. That among the eight cases also pending in front of the United States Supreme Court. A program note for our next broadcast coming up here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. We're going to spend some time in our future broadcast talking about this major decision that Judge Tanya Chutkan right now has in front of her, deciding in that immunity case what she is supposed to do in the wake of the Supreme Court granting a president broad immunities. We'll talk about the options that she has, how it is she can get to certain results based not only upon what the prosecution has said she should do, but what the defense is advocating as well. What options does she have? How will she resolve this major issue now in front of her? And secondarily, we're also going to take a look at another issue much out there. This one has to do with the coming election and who we elect as the next president of the United States of America. We're going to be addressing the question, could a president really use the Justice Department, the trappings of the Justice Department, to jail or otherwise punish his or her rivals? What are the uses that the Justice Department could be put to affect those kinds of things, to accomplish, if you will, some political retribution? Are those mechanisms in place? How could that be done in a new administration under the present system, under a future system that does not regard the rule of law as being prime in our system of justice? What does that look like if, frankly, Donald Trump wins? Could he really use the Justice Department to seek retribution against his rivals, as he has said he would do if he becomes president? We'll talk about the mechanisms inside the Department of Justice. All of that and more here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Thank you for being a part of our discussion this weekend, and continue to watch and be a part of the news coming out of the Supreme Court, including as we reported here on Amicus, a law review. Have a good weekend, everybody.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Up North News Radio.
Maggie Dawn.
Next, I'm joined by Will Ragland, Center for American Progress Action Fund's Vice President of Research. We're going to talk about Trump's failed record on manufacturing. Don't miss
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekday afternoons from 2 till 4.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinee on Air with Jane Matinee. Weekdays 10 till noon on the Talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM WLCX, and on the Civic Media app.
the back seat. Check the back seat.
Gets in your head, right? Good, because every year dozens of children are forgotten in the back seat. Cars get hot fast and can be deadly. So get it in your head. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us. Soaring high above La Crosse. This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse. And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.